throwaway. You could be.
Well, hello there, everyone. Thanks for tuning again for our second episode in our brand new series called Passports, Please. I'm Dr. Chick Morgan, the cowgirl diva.
And I'm Rodney Bersiel, the photographer and
the
traveler.
Dude, the photo dude. We're going to go. The diva and the dude. Okay. Well, we want to welcome you back. We hope you enjoyed our early effort. Passports, Please is a podcast with conversations about all kinds of journeys, geographic, personal, spiritual, inside, outside, countries. So we have a lot of territory to cover. And we came about this, as if you listened last week, because Rodney and I found out we have this somewhat bizarre and passionate affinity for our passports, such as they are, and the journeys that they take us on. So that's how we came to be. And you know, Rodney, passports were actually in the news this week, believe it or not.
I saw a bit of that. I didn't catch the whole thing, but yeah, I've...
Well, it's a little tricky. Somebody is suggesting, it probably was the government, and happily I think they've shot so many holes in it, about immunity passports.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can demonstrate that you have immunity against the COVID-19 before you enter a country or you leave another one. Of course, it's just fraught with all kinds of problems. But the idea of using that phrase, immunity passport, really speaks to exactly what we're talking about, the validation to move from one place to another. I was here, and now I'm there. So I'm going to keep a check on that to see what they do with that.
Well, and when they say that, or they're saying if you have had it and they think you're now, you have antibodies, is that what it is? Or are they waiting until they have a... You know, what am I trying to say? You know,
the vaccine.
You have to prove that you've taken the vaccine, or
well, all I read about it.
That's not an option right now.
Yeah, right. So nobody's going to be going anywhere still. No, this was some kind of a documentation to be determined that would let whoever let you enter the country know that you are COVID-19 free. So even right there, you and I are going, how is that going to work? So luckily there are more bureaucratic brains than ours that can figure that out. But we are so excited about doing this podcast. We've been talking about it for a long time. And we want to spend just a minute to talk about what's coming up. So we're going to start an overview today on a series of conversations, the two of us, about the large topic of Africa.
Very large topic.
Very large topic. And you know, Rodney, we always have these great conversations before we remember to push the start button, you know, on the audio.
Record the rehearsal,
yes. But what came out of that was, I think I'd mentioned to you that I certainly have enjoyed your photographs and your experiences there. And you and I are both have read, it turns out, a glorious book about colonial British East Africa around the turn of the 20th century. And I kept thinking, I've never been to Africa. I want to go to Africa. Oh, how come I haven't been? And I've been just thinking this and saying this for weeks now. And then it occurred to me, no, wait, I've been to Egypt. I think that counts. And you had a really good explanation or comment about that.
It does count. And I was guilty of this before I went, but I don't remember who it was, but I've had somebody pointed out to me, whenever you go on a trip, you know, I went to the Cayman Islands, I went to Italy, I went to France, I went to Russia, but anywhere within Africa, no one ever says, I'm going to Kenya, I'm going to Tanzania, I'm going to Ethiopia. They always say, I'm going to Africa.
Yeah.
But once you go and you get back, you know, where did you go? Oh, I went to Kenya. I went to Tanzania. You know, it's...
And it's very clear in your mind, having been there, how different all these places are.
Yes. And yeah. And of course, you know, Africa's huge. And it's just, it's crazy. And again, I was guilty of it too. But you know, when you talk to people, people don't seem to comprehend how big Africa is and what is there. And it's just, it's a strange thing to discuss. You know,
Well, and because of your photography, primarily, you have been to a lot of interesting places, to the Caribbean and to Cuba, to the south of France, and a lot of other places. So why don't you share how and why Africa? Like you say, that's a big nut to crack and tackle. I'm mixing all kinds of metaphors here. But how did you end up even thinking about going?
I wish I knew. You know, there's always little seeds being planted throughout your whole life, I guess, that, you know, and what came first, I don't have a clue. I mean, like these books were part of it.
And the books you're holding are?
Actually, and I say that, I haven't even read this one yet, but it's on my list. It's The West with the Night and then Circling the Sun that we were talking about. And it's like with Circling the Sun, you know, when I read that, their interaction with the Maasai there and the way it's written, there's this whole mystique about them and the way they're interacting with these tribes. And when you think about a lot of these tribes, they're not accessible, you know, and you don't speak their language. How do you communicate with them? And it's kind of scary, I guess, you know, to, you know, go into something you know nothing about. And I'm reading about these people, and like I said, everything I've read, they come across as such a interesting and mysterious group. And so that was part of it. And of course, you know, then my, you know, with my photography, I love the big animals. You know, I love elephants, I love giraffes, and the big cats, and wanting to see that, and that's the place to go do it. But it just, there's been all these little seeds my whole life, mm-hmm. And it's always been on my bucket list, and it just finally happened. And I knew before I went that once I did go, that it just, it's going to suck you in, and mm-hmm. you're not going to want to do anything else. I could literally spend the rest of my life over there photographing. And because,
so we better talk fast and get a lot of these episodes
have a lot of episodes because it's been a long time coming.
Well, you mentioned how once you've been there, you're never the same. You are transformed. Mm-hmm. Exactly what we're talking about with the whole passports concept. And this book, Circling the Sun, is written by a woman named Paula McLean. And it's the story of Beryl Markham, who had a bunch of other names. Very fascinating woman. Part of the British East Africa colonization during the early 1900s into about 1930 or so. I knew Beryl Markham only through that book you just mentioned, West of the Night, which she wrote, one of my top 10 desert islands that I can fit it in my backpack, book, beautiful stories. But I had no idea about her connection with the land and what it meant to her. And I also had no idea of her relationship with Isak Dinesen, who wrote Out of Africa. And if that's not one of the most romantic, engaging stories, not only a human story, but a story of romanticism and engagement with the land and the people, I don't know what is. But one of the comments that, one of the lines that Paula McLean wrote in Circling the Sun, I happened to write down because it reminded me so much of you when I read it. And I'm paraphrasing here because I couldn't find it again. But it's certainly taken hold of my mind. And it says, Africa takes your heart from the outside in, and then your soul from the inside out.
It's very true.
So tell me how you've experienced that, and why is that true for you?
I don't know that it can be explained. You know, Hemingway, I think it was Hemingway, he had a quote that was, he was talking about laying in bed, and he was getting ready to go home. You know, wherever home was at that time, may have still been Cuba, I don't know, wherever he was. But he said, I haven't even left yet, and already missed this place. Mm. And then there was another one that may or may not have been him, I think it was. But he said, I am jealous of everyone that hasn't been to Africa yet, because they don't know what they're in for. So again, you know, paraphrasing.
Because they'll experience it for the first time again. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's just what it does to you. When reading on the Maasai the first time, the first time I met some of the people there, and it just, when you see them, you know, they're in their traditional wardrobe, their clothing, and it's like running into a rock star here. Mm. You know, it's like, you know, there's Aerosmith walking down the road or something, you know, it's like, it just, and in fact, I haven't had that, you know, in my life and the things that I've done. I've met a lot of celebrities and it's
literal
not
rock stars.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
And it, these meeting these guys was even more than that. Yeah. It was, cause there is to me, you know, such a mystery because it's something you just, you know, it's a long way away from here and you just read about it in books. And then when you encounter it, it just, it was incredible. But
well, let's back up a little bit because as people who have been following you and your photography for years know, as you said, you like the big animals, you like the sharks and the whales and the rays of all kinds, we established last time, the Cuban crocodiles, the wild horses. So how did you actually end up on this spectacularly important and moving adventure and journey to Africa?
This one, like I said, it's been on my bucket list for a long time, but Africa, to do it right, it's not a cheap trip. You know, it's not something you just go over for a week or so. And I had originally was like, well, I can, you know, I can pull off 2 weeks. That'll be sort of enough. But then last year, my life kind of took a strange turn and I didn't travel as much as I normally do. So inadvertently, I was saving a bunch of money. And then when all this was able to come about, I had the money in my account that I needed to go and do it right. So a 2 week trip all of a sudden turns into a 5 week trip. And yeah, I went with a buddy of mine and he loves planning trips. The part that I hate.
Everybody needs a friend like that, right? At least you and I do.
Yeah, I'm just like, just get me there. I don't need to plan anything.
Totally.
Just get me on a plane, get me a spot and I'll figure it out when I'm there. But he just loves planning. And he was constantly calling and sending me emails and links and check this out, check this out, check this out. And he organized the most amazing trip. Hmm. And we had 10 days in Tanzania through the Serengeti with a Maasai that was the most incredible guide. I mean, eagle eyes, could spot anything. I mean, got us in some of the most amazing things that, and it, people that I've talked, and even he said it. He's like, you know, I can't tell you how lucky you guys are. And every day was like that for us.
Is this somebody that your friend already knew?
No, we just
got luck of the draw, or
well, there was a, I can't remember the name of the company, but there was a company that he had contacted, and he told us that we're, you know, photographers. This is what we're wanting to do. This is what we want to focus on. We want a guide that can get us in these places, these situations, and he got us the most amazing person there was. And so, yeah, to not go on too long with it about all that, but yeah, after that we had 10 days. We went flew to Kenya and did 10 days there. We went to Amboseli, which is primarily the elephants where, you know, Tim and Craig are. You know, Tim has unfortunately left us, but the two, you know, biggest land mammals in the world.
You'd heard about them before at a time.
Yeah. But it was funny. It didn't quite grasp me. You know, like now I'm obsessed with them. Now that I've been there and met Craig, you know, like I said, didn't get to meet Tim. But once you see it, you know, it, like I said, it just didn't grab me. I wasn't expecting what it was.
You know, I would have to imagine that would be true in a lot of ways. So you have expectations, but until you're there, you think, well, that's not anything like what I thought was going to happen. And Africa is so big. Where did you start? Because you were on the move the whole time. You were there for what, 4 weeks?
5 weeks.
5 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. So where did you start in such a journey?
We started, the safari started in northern Serengeti in Tanzania. And we literally just, we drove through the entire Serengeti for 10 days. Mm. And again, this, our guide, he knew that the Serengeti backwards and forwards. He knew where everything was. And on top of that, you know, just knowing animals' instincts and what they're going to do and where they're going to go and how they're going to react. And he just put us in some amazing places. And, you know, any section of this trip, I could go back and do, you know, focus just on that. But to think that I did all this in one trip, it just, it's mind-blowing what we were able to experience. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there were some trips that, some parts of it before we got there, I kind of felt like they were fillers. You know, like there's, you know, those albums where it's all these great songs and then there's two or three songs on there that you're going, why did they stick this one in there?
I needed to get something there.
And I felt like that's what some of these were going to be. And then you get there and you just fall in love with those places too for completely different reasons. What,
give me one example of that, one that you thought was going to be a filler.
Well, honestly, Chulu Hills. I guess I didn't, because it's, and well, before Chulu Hills, we went to Amboseli, which is where, you know, it's mainly elephants. You don't even see much of anything else. It's just, there's just hundreds of elephants. And that was the main thing that I wanted. And Chulu Hills was right after that. So I didn't want to leave Amboseli. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, so by default, Chula Hills was the bad place, and got over there. And I was like, oh my God.
You know, what was there?
It's the rolling hills. Mm. And it is known for elephants, but we were there during, or well, it was supposed to be the dry season, but rains came in early. And so everything was lush and green. And when that happens, you know, the animals tend to disperse and they're not congregating at water holes. But so we didn't see a lot of elephants, but there were tons of giraffes. And at this particular camp where we stayed, you know, they've got a little watering hole there, and they've got one of those shipping crates that they've buried halfway in the ground and cut a hole so you're ground level at this watering hole. And it was funny because we had been driving around for a couple hours and weren't really seeing anything. So we decided just to go back to camp and wait and come back in the afternoon. And we walk up and I look down and there's, you know, there were, what, five giraffes, I think, sitting down at the watering hole.
Sitting down?
Well, or hanging out at the watering hole.
Oh, okay.
So I go down there and just in awe, because you're so close because they can't see you. And it's crazy, the elephants, how as big as they are, as quiet as they can be. Because I'm literally sitting here looking out, taking photos of the giraffe. Elephants walk right in front of my camera. Never heard them. And just to be there that close in these wild animals. And so I guess what I'm saying, it was like unfortunately with the rain, it wasn't the best part of the trip at that time, but now seeing, you know, weather-wise and hitting it at the right spot, it would by far be one of my favorite places. Because who it was, but there's a photographer that's involved with that. I wish I could remember her name, but if I want to say she's part owner of it, but she. Our guide there said that there are times when she's there, she'll just go sit on at the watering hole all day long. Because the stuff that comes in, it just, you know, zebras and lions and elephants and giraffes, and it's just all, and you're sitting there right in the middle of them.
This would be a good time, I think, to remind our listeners, if those of you that know Rodney and his work will already know about his website, rodneyburciel.com, rodneyburciel.com, all one word. And it might be a good idea if you're not driving, if you could pull up his website while we're talking, because just to get a sense of these photographs will just give you a sense, small sense, of the trip. I've been wondering, we talked about how you just, you literally parachuted into Africa, big A, I'm putting air quotes here. What?
I'll parachute in next time.
yeah, like your life's not exciting enough, Ronnie, let's do that. Just jump out of the plane.
I can get some aerial shots that way.
But there you are in this enormous country and just literally jumping headlong into this experience which you've never had before. How did you approach your photography when you first got there? How did you figure out, how am I going to wrap my head around this and get this the way I want to get it?
I don't think I honestly put that much effort or thought process into it. And maybe I think just after doing this for so long, I think things just kind of come natural. Because I remember when I first started doing photography, when I first started taking it seriously, you know, I was doing, when I do portrait work, and I do a lot of locations shoots, and I would spend days going and looking for the spot, and then analyzing the spot, and then researching how I'm going to do this, how I'm going to do that. And now I guess things are finally just ingrained in my head now, and I literally just show up and I see things. And of course, you know, with nature, you know, it's not like you can plan a lot of things. You know, you never know what the light's going to be like. You know, is it going to be rainy? Is it going to be cloudy? Is it going to be sunny? You know, so I adapt to whatever's going on. And you know, you don't know what you're going to see. You know, you're out looking for elephants and then, you know, a pride of lion shows up. You know, so it's, you just got to be on your toes. And somebody asked me that recently, but when I'm shooting, you know, I'm always looking at the whole picture. Mm-hmm. I'm not just, you know, if there's an elephant, I'm not just looking at the elephant. I'm looking at horizon line and trees and clouds and anything else that I can get into that photo to make it, you know, to tell a story. And then if that's not happening, then I'll zoom in, and that's when I start getting, you know, eyeballs and, you know, I'm always adapting to what's going on around me.
Did that change at all during your 5 weeks there? I mean, my hunch would be that you're reacting intuitively because of all your experience. But now you've had 2, 3, 4 weeks in this particular environment. Did you gain a different kind of intuition about how to work with the animals and the landscape and all of that, or is it just still coming right from the gut?
No, it's all straight from the gut. And I guess, you know, after several years of swimming with sharks and whales and dolphins and crocodiles, and you know, there's definitely not a fear factor there. Mm. You know, if they would have let me, I would have jumped out of the Jeep and gone, you know, even closer, you know, if I could have. So yeah, and there are, you know, of course there are those limitations. You know, when you're in the parks, you know, they've got the rules on, you know, what you can and can't do. So, you know, there are other, you know, those restrictions that you've got to work around, and which is a little frustrating at times because, I go, you know, go swimming with crocodiles and it's pretty much just do whatever you want, you know, go get face to face with them. And then, you know, then there's an elephant and, you know, you can't do the same thing, you know, just because of rules. And so, it's adapting to the situations. And
we have so much to talk about over the coming weeks, months, years, even before you get lost totally in Africa and nobody knows where you are anymore. You had mentioned, well, the first thing you mentioned was about the Maasai. Tell me a little bit about that. Do they call them tribes there? Is that an appropriate use of the term?
Yeah.
And were they throughout the whole Serengeti and throughout all of your travels? What was your first encounter with them?
Honestly, the first camp we stayed in, you know, all the camps, you know, hire local. But, you know, a lot of them, you don't realize that they're Maasai. But there were camps where they did still wear their traditional clothing. You know, some camps, they're wearing the camp's, you know, uniform or whatever.
Or like khakis and a polo shirt.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of the camps, I, let them wear, their traditional clothes. And, when, like I said, the first time I saw it, I don't remember which camp it was, but when I first saw it, I was just, we were talking about earlier, just seeing that celebrity kind of feeling. Mm. And but they're the nicest people. Their commitment to, their jobs and their family and their life and whatever it is they take on, they're 100%. Mm-hmm. It's like these elephant orphanages. When they bring in a new, an orphaned elephant, a person is assigned to that elephant and they literally spend 24/7 with these elephants. So they're in there, there was one camp, almost all the camps did it. Your tents were considerable walking distance from the main ground, where you would eat, and I say restaurant loosely, but in the evenings they would have to walk you to your tent just to protect you from, lions or, anything else that may come out. At night, they'll sit there, and when you're done with your evening and ready to go back to the room, they'll walk you down to the room, and then they'll sit outside your tent all night long. And then when you wake up in the morning, they're sitting there waiting on you, and they walk you back up, and then they go sleep during the day. And they get, I think, a week or so off per month or whatever to go back and see their families. But it's just,
what does one do to protect someone else from a lion?
There's all kind of stories with, the Maasai and lions. Originally they were, lion hunters. And of course, with education and environmental concerns and, they're being educated, and it's as far as, the need for them. And so that's been cut back a lot, but there's a mutual respect between the Maasai and the lions. It's like the lions just know. We're not going to mess with those guys.
Huh.
But when they've grown up in that environment, they know the demeanor and how animals are going to react. And it's something I'll never understand. There's a respect and an understanding of nature there. And they know how to interact. And
I wonder if that's been developed over thousands of years.
There's no fear. It's like people ask me, when I'm swimming with a shark, are you scared? And it's like, I'm a little nervous, but you don't want to show any fear. And I think it's the same thing. They're not afraid of them. And the animals can sense that. And so,
sitting here just thinking of that person sleeping outside your tent and how happy you must have been to see him when you woke up.
Well, the first,
if he wasn't there, that'd be a problem.
The first time it happened. Well, and during the day, it's not that, it's not an issue, but there, of course there were mornings where, we'd get up at 4:30 and, it's still dark when you'd walk out. But the first night that happened, I remember the guy, walking me down, and then I walk out the next morning and it's the same guy still standing. And I asked him, I said, "You've been standing here all night long?"
He's they stand.
Well, I don't know.
You were asleep, right?
Yeah. But he was standing there when I got up. So I don't know. Maybe he saw my lights come on and got up.
You mentioned something just a few minutes ago about elephant orphanages.
Mm-hmm.
What are those, and when did you encounter them or first encounter them?
Well, we went to two. The big main one is the David Sheldrick in Nairobi, and which is another great book that you need to read. It's called An African Love Story, and it was, I think Daphne Sheldrick wrote it, David Sheldrick's wife. And she recently passed away. And he passed away, quite a while ago, and she started this in his honor. But he was a huge conservationist, and you know, protecting elephants, I think, started back in the 60s, maybe even before that. But it's grown and grown. Now it's a huge deal, but you know, there's always, you know, elephants are, you know, the babies are falling into wells or they get trapped in mud and the family can't rescue them and they eventually just have to abandon them because there's just nothing they can do. So, you know, farmers are either coming across them or, you know, there are, you know, aerials, you know, people, you know, there's the groups that are flying over looking for this kind of thing. And then when they find one, they'll report it and there's a group that'll go in and, you know, dig them out of the mud or pull them out of the well, or, and they'll always try and find the families and try and, you know, reintegrate them back. But when they don't, then they bring them into the orphanages. And, I think it's a 3-year process before they're ready to be reintroduced back into the wild. But it's an amazing project, you know, with their,
What is the success rate of those that can be released?
I don't know. A friend of mine, he lived over there for a couple of years, and he actually went and volunteered at Sheldrick. And I posted something on one of my Instagram posts a while back.
And your Instagram account is called?
Just my name. Yeah, just Rodney Bersiel.
Okay. That's for our listeners.
And, yeah. I don't remember what the post was, but it was talking about this. And he messaged me, and we got to talking about, you know, there, unfortunately, you know, there's a lot that, and it's not because of, it's just there by the, a lot of the, by the time they get to them, they're just, you know, they're just too far gone and they don't recover. But there are some that there's like, oh my God, this thing isn't going to make it. And somehow they pull through, you know? So yeah, I don't know what the numbers are, but, you know, just the fact that they're able to, you know, they're doing what they're doing and saving any of them is.
How do they reacclimate them into the wild? Because they're very much a family or herd, a group.
Yeah, they're a matriarchal society, and even in the orphanage, there is a hierarchy, and it's, you know, traditionally it's the oldest female. She takes over the role. And then, and even within the babies, you know, the orphans, there's, you know, the oldest one at the time is kind of the leader. And then after 3 years, you know, give or take, they'll slowly start reintroducing them. Cause in like Tsavo Park is a big one where they'll go and release, and there's herds of orphaned elephants that have been released, and they've created that bond, and now they're
interesting.
So when they've got one that's ready, they'll take it out and introduce, see how they react. And again, I don't know what the statistics are on that either, but I think it's fairly high that, you know, they let them in and become part of that family. And so yeah, it's a very successful program. And Tsavo is a area that I want to, I think it's one of the largest, if not the largest, preserves in Kenya.
How do you spell that?
It's Tsavo. And yeah, there's hundreds, thousands of elephants over there, and it's a big area of where they're re-releasing them back into the wild.
There's a book that I've always wanted to read, and I hope some of the listeners have, because I've heard about it forever. I know you and I talked about it once. It's called When Elephants Weep, about the emotional life of animals. And that's certainly something I'm getting more educated around just by reading, not certainly not being there, about the family instincts of elephants and that mother and child and how they all, you know, pull together. And did you witness how much of that when you were
a lot
there?
It was amazing to see, and there were tons of babies, you know, there were some that were probably not even a couple months old, and just tiny little things, and you've got, and I've got some photos that are on, they're not on my website yet, but they're on my Instagram.
Okay. But just the, so if our listeners go to your Instagram and just scroll or search for,
yeah, in fact, there's probably more there than, well, there is more there than on my website right now, because mm-hmm. Instagram's just easier to update than my website is.
And there lies the tale. Okay.
But yeah, the, you come across these herds, and elephants tend to, most herds that you see are primarily female. You've got the matriarch, and then that herd is traditionally, it's her daughters and, you know, cousins. And the males, when they reach a certain age, I think it's, you know, 10 or 11 years old, they tend to take off, and they're kind of loners. So when you see a large herd, it's usually a group of females, and they're all a family. And the males will leave, and then when they go into full musk, when they're, you know, ready to do their thing, they'll go and find these female herds and try and impress the woman and, you know, procreate, and then he moves on. But the, like I said, the moms and daughters and sisters and cousins, they all stick together. And that whole herd helps with the newborn. You know, the baby will stay with the mom, but then sometimes they'll go off and start playing with, you know, the brother or the cousin. And if they ever feel threatened, and I witnessed it a couple times where they'll start trumpeting, and they'll just circle that baby to protect it. Hmm. And one of the times it was probably, I think we caused it, not knowing. But there was a herd that was down by the river, and we were off in the Jeep, and they had all started walking off. And so we pulled in a little bit closer, and there was a small group. There were like three of them still at the river, and I guess they didn't see us. And when they turned around and saw us, the mom starts trumpeting, and all those elephants came back and circled and then walked the baby off.
Wow.
So yeah, I felt bad that we had, you know, inadvertently.
But what a photo op. The picture.
but just to see it, mm-hmm. you know, that interaction and that bond, and it's
amazing. I listen to you, and this has always been my experience, Rodney, of talking to you about your experiences, of which you take photographs or you immerse yourself in photography. Is how deeply captivated you are by them. And what I'm experiencing listening to you talk about Africa is this sense of there's still on this planet someplace that is so rare and so precious and so uncontaminated by technology.
Mm-hmm.
That it is one of the few places where, I mean, you have, you know, a masterpiece of technology with your camera, but the whole focus, the emphasis, the heartstrings are on the actual creatures themselves and how you experience that. And I have to assume there are other places on the planet where that's possible, but it's such a footprint of the experience of being there. It's how you talk about it and how other people, I'm sure, that you've talked to have been there. There's almost probably like an instant brotherhood, I would imagine, of, oh, yeah, yeah, you were there too. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? I mean, or am I just romanticizing all of this?
No, I mean, it has kind of ruined me for this world. I used to be a very social person and wanting to always be out and, you know, the city life and this and that. And now I just, all I want to do is be out in nature and be in the middle of nowhere and not hearing any sounds or any noises and other than what nature is creating.
Yeah.
And
so what's that like, particularly in the middle of the night?
It's just, oh my God. You know, my very first night in the Serengeti, I was in a tent by myself, and you know, you're laying there, and you wake up at 2 in the morning, and you know, there's lions couple hundred yards away, just roaring. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't heard that before, mm-hmm. again, that's one of those things. There's no way to describe it because it's so loud and it's so deep and it just, but it's so soothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to lay there in bed.
That's an interesting
word. It's crazy. And, but yeah, just to, like I said, just being laying there and there's nothing but a piece of fabric between you and whatever's going on out there. And, the hyenas come in and you hear them circling your tent and, the elephant's trumpeting and there's always these crazy noises and there's no traffic, there's no cars other than the other people that you encounter when you're out. But going back, I got to Chulu Hills when we were talking about that. A lot of these camps, there are areas where there's too many cars and too much traffic. And those were the areas like, oh my God, get me out of here. But Chulu Hills, we were pretty much literally the only car or truck. Mm. Never encountered anybody else there.
Mm.
We were talking about this whole, quarantine thing. If I knew then what I knew now, I would have timed it a little bit better and gotten stuck in Kenya.
Well, that was one of the things I was curious about, and I jumped to it, was what do you wish you'd known before you headed into Africa? It's like, okay, I think there's going to be a global pandemic and I can wait it out here with the elephants.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you wish you'd known before, and how could that have made your experience different?
I don't know. That probably, honestly, probably nothing.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I do it every trip. There's very few trips, if any, that I don't repeat.
Mm.
Because, obviously for me, it's the two main purposes. I love being in nature and experiencing that. And of course, my photography. And I love coming home, downloading my photos and going through and editing and doing my thing. And then I see things that I wish I had done differently. Mm. So I want to go back and then try and recreate recreate what I saw in my head or from that it inspired me from this photo. So I don't think there's anything that I felt like I wish I had known going into it. And it's like we were talking about earlier, like planning trips. I'm not a planner. And I love to go in knowing nothing. Mm. And because I think, expectations are ruin anything, relationships to, so if you go in with no expectations and again, these resorts, the places I was like, that doesn't sound any good. But that's because I had done a little reading beforehand and I didn't see, there wasn't something that appealed to me, I guess. But then when I got there, it completely changed my mind. So I went in with a negative point of view. And what would have happened if I went in knowing absolutely nothing about it?
Right. And
Like every morning, if somebody just says, wakes me up and says, okay, we're going, and you just take off and just waiting for whatever is going to happen. Because it's like Tim, that morning that we've spotted Tim, we're going to go find him. We didn't get him. So it, ended up being a, can't say a bad day because I was in Kenya, but it didn't meet my expectations. But if we had left that morning and I said, hey, we're going out.
There is so much in that last 90 seconds that you just said that is such a lesson, at least for me, a reminder for me about just how you live your life in general. The fact that we become prisoners of our expectations and accepting other people's expectations, but that mm-hmm. unfiltered joy and recognizing the mm-hmm. opportunity while you are living it is so hard to do. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. kind of looking at you again mm-hmm. going, wow, this is amazing experience, this amazing place, all these great stories. For me, the real story here, when we talk about the story behind the story, is that attitude of, I know nothing, this is not my world, I don't want it to color my thinking, give me anything I should be looking for, that results in not only your experiences, but what you can do through your photography to help other people have just a scintilla of that experience. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you know how rare a gift that is, or probably it's not true everywhere, like, you know, I've developed some very severe expectations about going to HEB to go grocery shopping. And I'm mad before I even find a parking lot, if I can find a parking spot. But I think that's just a wonderful theme that I want to continue to return to. One of the other quotes I came across in these books that we were reading, don't even remember, it was from Unknown. You know, I wish I had that portfolio that Unknown has written, but I was thinking about you.
Best
again.
Best author ever.
It says, we take photos as a return ticket to a moment otherwise gone. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just a beautiful way to capture it. I mean, at least it did to me. So
yeah, I go back through old photos and mm-hmm. relive.
That's why we loved our passports.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't photos, but they were stamps. And do you have a stamp for Kenya?
Of course,
he says.
I wouldn't have come back without it.
Well, there's your excuse for staying over
that's,
there.
That's half the reason I went, was to get that stamp.
I'm one of the few people that understand that.
I'll drop $20,000 for a stamp.
Let's bring this to a close, because there is a lot more that we can talk about, a lot more about Africa. I'm interested in hearing more of your stories, you know, your Jay Peterman stories, of your interactions with the actual animals and the countryside, and really to put maybe a bell jar around specific animals and what you learn from them. And there's more to talk about. So that's what we're going to be doing for the next, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks, at least on this go-around, but there's always going to be more to circle back to. I found a quote from somebody named John Hemingway. I don't know if the Hemingway had a son or grandson named John.
Yeah, he had a few. I think he had 2 or 3 sons.
Yes, he did.
And I think there was a John.
In that another book by Paula McLean that we were talking about Hemingway and Martha Gellhorn.
Yeah, so when I was looking her up, there was all the siblings came up.
Yes. Yeah, he had 3 sons by his second wife, Pauline. So anyway, as Jean Hemingway said, if I have ever seen magic, it has been in Africa. And that's what I'm hearing from you, and I can't wait to explore more fully.
Yeah.
So in terms of other things that we want to talk about, what's a challenge that you would leave with our listeners, just something for them to think about or explore, or as we dive more deeply into this part of your photography and your journal? Anything you would...
Other than cut the expectations?
Yeah, that's a good one. I just think that we can't top that one.
Who was it? There was a street photographer in New York, and that was his quote. Somebody asked him about, you know, how do you get all these great photos? He said, it's F8 and be there. You know, you just got to show up.
You got to show up.
You got to be there.
Yeah. Woody Allen said, 90% of life is showing up, or somebody did. Mm-hmm. Hopefully somebody out there will correct me, because I just like to make this stuff up. And just a reminder to please go on Rodney's website, Rodney, RodneyBurseil.com, and his Instagram account, which is also Rodney mm-hmm. Burseil, to see some of, if you haven't already, you're probably listening because you've been an avid follower of his work for years. But in light of the conversation we've just had, I encourage you to go back and look at some of these amazing photos. And next week we'll talk about the photos and the in color versus black and white. controversy that's raging in your head.
That would be a good one. I wish we could have people call in for that one. Because
we're new at this. Let's hold that expectation or that hope. Expectation is the wrong word I just learned. So let's hold that hope. And I hope at some point we will be able to do that because this is all such fascinating stuff. It has so many levels. It's, you know, the personal journey. It's artistic, the art of what you're doing. And certainly the transformational nature, which is a result of all of it. So until next time, may we have your passports, please. We'll see you soon.